Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring me, Lib Dem blogger Mark Thompson, and also regularly featuring Labour blogger Emma Burnell. Good evening, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
Hello. We don't have a guest this week. It is Sunday the 17th of February, and as usual, we're going to talk about issues from the previous week in politics. The one that we thought we'd start with is the, in some ways, surprising announcement. Maybe some people might argue it's surprising that Ed Miliband's announced a policy at all, but he has announced that he wants to bring back the 10p tax rate, and that's going to be linked to a mansion tax. So obviously this has stirred up a few feathers amongst the political classes, not least because the mansion tax is a tax that is more readily associated with the Lib Dems, although they've been unable to implement it in government because basically the Conservatives have stopped them from doing so. It's a particular baby of Vince Cable, and it looks like Labour are, I wouldn't say stealing the policy, but it's certainly heavily based upon on that. And obviously the 10p rate is something that was abolished by Gordon Brown in his last budget and then caused him all kinds of problems once he was Prime Minister. So Emma, what are your thoughts about this? Presumably you're pleased that there's some flesh going onto the bones, and it's flesh that is causing problems for other parties.
Yeah, I mean, it's brilliant as far as I'm concerned. It's good policy and it's good politics. Having a costed policy that helps people to earn more, take home more of their wages, whilst also making sure that you're taking that money from the people who have the broadest shoulders, absolutely fine. I mean, Ed has always said that the Labour Party don't have the monopoly on good ideas. We might, in fact, have the monopoly on an ability to implement those. Let's see what happens in 2015. So I'm quite happy to say, yeah, the Lib Dems had a good idea. We'll have that and we'll implement it. I'm very, very, I think that the way that it was announced was clever. I think we played the politics really well. If we want to go into a bit of Kremlinology or whatever it's called.
You can never say that word, can you?
I can't.
You need to find another word.
One day I will learn my limitations, Mark. I don't know how to say it in a more normal way. If you want to just talk about what they're doing and shove. Basically, it makes perfect sense. It's a really, really clever policy because it puts the Lib Dems in a difficult position, particularly as we're going to call a parliamentary vote on it, because they know that they're trying to negotiate this behind the scenes with George Osborne. Labour are saying, no, we want to hear your policy out front. Do you support it? Don't you support it? Very, very difficult for Lib Dems, which we're not that unhappy about. Right in the middle of a by-election, of course. It divides the coalition parties right in the middle of a by-election, of course. And also it's a very, very clear message with the reinstatement of the 10p tax that, it's a break with the past. It's a break with Gordon Brown. Some of the things that were said about that decision, particularly by Ed Balls, would have been quite hurtful to his former mentor, Gordon Brown. And that was necessary in order for both Eds to break with the past. So good politics, good policy, good week.
Yeah, I'm not sure I totally agree with everything you've said there. There was a piece by Andrew Rawnsley in The Observer today where he thought that it was good politics but not a good policy, although I have to say when I read his piece he didn't really seem to have that much argument against the policy. He was more kind of deferring to analyses that have claimed that it doesn't do very much, and there'd be better ways to spend the money. I think in terms of the way it was announced, I think it was good that it was a surprise and it wasn't really trailed in advance, and even to the point where I think Cameron at PMQs the day before had said that he was going to make a speech that wasn't going to have any substance in it or wasn't going to have anything interesting in it, which is a bit of a foolhardy thing to say, isn't it? I mean, how was he supposed to know?
Apparently the real clue that something was coming was watching Ed Balls' face when David Cameron said that and how absolutely pleased as punch he was that he'd fallen into that trap.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, in terms of the vote that they're going to call on an opposition day, presumably.
Yeah.
I wrote a piece for Lib Dem Voice today. I actually wrote it yesterday, but it went up today about this, which is that I suppose in some ways I'm a bit disappointed about that, because I kind of thought this might have been the Labour Party stretching out an open hand to the Lib Dems. I mean, one of the things that I think is going to be taken more seriously in the run-up to the next election than it was at the previous election is how compatible parties are with each other. I think now that we've got a coalition and we've seen that they can work, we could argue to exactly what extent this has or hasn't worked.
Yeah, not entirely sure you're proving it works.
Okay, but it clearly functions. I mean, the government hasn't fallen apart. You know, it's 2.5 years in and it's still going. And that fact means that, you know, we are now aware that these things can work. So I thought that this might be a way of trying to change the game a little bit, so that when you're trying to do the tessellation between the parties and which policies fit with, you know, obviously a mansion tax and also a measure at the lower end that is trying to reduce the tax burden on the lower paid. OK, it's not exactly the same as the Lib Dem policy, but the close stablemates. I had hoped that this was, like I say, a gesture. And actually, I think it's not that. I think it's what has now happened, it's turned into politicking, because trying to call a vote on this and trying to embarrass the Lib Dems, are you going to vote for it? Are you not going to vote for it? I mean, it's deliberately trying to misunderstand what collective government is about. I mean, the Lib Dems are in a government. They have an agreed budget. They can't just go and vote for fiscal measures that they want in their own right against their own government. It's an agreed package that they're currently implementing. And Ed Miliband...
Well, they said that about boundaries. So, you know, it's
No. Well, boundaries is...
The piece of law introduced by Nick Clegg.
No, boundaries, as far as I'm concerned, is different. I'm not going to get into all the details of, you know, what is attached to what in the coalition agreement, because... You know, Tories will disagree with me on this until the end of time. And we don't have any here for me to argue with, but they definitely would. And I know what their argument is. It's that the boundary changes were linked to the AV referendum. Now, I disagree. I do think that the reform package was a whole package together. And once the Tories started backing away and, you know, reneging on their parts of it, then we really did have no obligation to follow through on our one. But when it comes to the financial measures, I mean, the main reason why this government came together in the way that it did so rapidly and, you know, with such force behind it, you know, we have to do this, is because during the coalition negotiations, chaos was happening in some European countries. The markets were all over the place and we really just had to get a grip on things. And I know that you'll argue, Emma, for example, and lots of others on the left will argue that we haven't done very well.
I will argue. Let me argue it.
Well, okay. But you, whatever people on the left might argue, I really do think that the financial side of this government...
Do you really think we were Greece? I mean, seriously, two and a half years ago, do you think we were Greece?
No, I don't think that.
In which case, it's not a real argument.
No, hang on. I've slightly wandered off on a tangent here. The point is, it's the financial policy that is at the core of this government. It's why it was formed. So if the Lib Dems start peeling off and voting for financial measures with the opposition against their own government, this government will collapse in a few days or a couple of weeks. It will just collapse. They cannot do it. And Ed Miliband knows this. That's why he's called it.
Last week, you were desperately trying to say that Labour should be fighting the Eastleigh by-election with everything it's got. You wanted us to throw the kitchen sink at it. Here's the kitchen sink, mate. This is what it looks like.
Yeah, I'm not saying...
We cannot separate the politicking of that by-election and what we do in opposition, because that is how we do things in this country. If you want to do something prominently politicking in a by-election, you do it in Parliament. And so we have thrown the kitchen sink at the Eastleigh by-election. We've got a fabulous candidate who brings amazing people in. And we are also playing politics on a national level that people in Eastleigh will see and recognise and understand.
Yeah. So when Ed Miliband says that he wants the Lib Dems to vote with him, he doesn't really mean that. He can't really mean that. And he can't think that they will.
He does want the Lib Dems to vote with him.
No, because if they do that, and then...
A few weeks.
Sorry?
Of course he wants the Lib Dems to vote with him. He'd like the Lib Dems to support a policy they believe in. And, you know, that is, it's up to the Lib Dems to make a choice as to whether they support a policy they believe in and or support policies they don't believe in and stick with this failing austerity government.
But, Emma, the logical conclusion of that is that if the Lib Dems did what he wants, the government would collapse, there'd be a general election. Now, if that general election resulted in another coalition government where Labour were the biggest party, but they didn't have a majority, and the Lib Dems were the junior partner. The first time the opposition of the day comes along and says, we're going to force an opposition vote on this policy that's a Lib Dem policy that Labour don't like, then how can Ed Miliband say, you can't vote that way? He's already said in opposition, as leader of the opposition, that junior partners in coalitions are allowed to vote however they want. So it seems like, I appreciate what you're saying. I know it's a by-election and it's campaigning and it's trying to embarrass the Lib Dems, but it does seem to be threatening the viability of a future coalition led by himself, because he just seems to be completely ignoring the rules of collective government, which is particularly surprising when this week he's admitted, and Ed Balls has admitted, that they didn't like the 10p tax rate, but they still voted for it when they were in government. So they clearly understand the strictures of collective responsibility and what it means in government.
Yeah, it's testing to have that collective responsibility, but you have to stand up and you have to either go say, we will vote against our principles because of a wider principle, or we will vote with our principles because we think this measure is important enough. And that is the tough decisions you make in government. It's the tough decisions you make in government, whether you're in an individual party or whether you're in a coalition. And I don't think Lib Dems understood that nearly enough when they constantly criticise Labour people for voting with things that they believe under collective responsibility. And now you're learning some very, very tough lessons. Welcome to the real world.
Well, I do think that they did understand that. Well, I understood it. I can't really speak for all of the Lib Dems. And, you know, I'm not going to argue that they haven't made some mistakes in government. To be honest, some of the mistakes were before they got into government, when they pledged things and promised things that realistically, given the political makeup of the, or likely political makeup of the rest of the parliament after the general election, wasn't going to be possible. But I do think I have a serious point here, because I think Ed Miliband is playing games in a way that he will regret in a few years' time, or could regret. Obviously, if Labour get an overall majority, no problem. And that's obviously what he's hoping. But he can't be sure that's going to happen. And if he does end up in a minority, you know, he might be forced to have a minority government if he carries on with these kind of games, because, you know, it might be that the Lib Dems just feel like they can't go into coalition.
That any Lib Dem who wants to be a minister in a government is going to go, oh, Ed Miliband wasn't very nice to us in government with him. That's not how people behave.
I'm trying to think which Lib Dem member of the coalition negotiation team would sound like that. I can't think.
Well, if I could have done a Scottish accent, maybe it would have been closer.
Oh, I see. Okay, here you go.
It was, to be fair, it was initially a generic Lib Dem, but as I carried on, I started seeing this slightly green tinted skin.
So you don't think there's any merit in my argument here at all? You just think I think
that the Lib Dems are learning about grown-up politics and recognise it as such. And having done that, will therefore be willing to make new negotiations and new agreements, and probably will make much better coalition agreements come the day that they get to go into a coalition government again, whether that's 2015, 2020, 2050, in the year 2525. You know, I think that lessons have been learned from the rather rushed and poorly written nature of the current coalition agreement.
I think that
people get politics. People who go into politics understand politics. They know what it means. You're talking as if Labour are the only people who have behaved like this. Now, OK, he's not in government anymore, but if he hadn't got divorced, Chris Huhne, who kicked off with Saeed Awasi the press conference of hate, the first anti-Labour government press conference of 2010. Yeah, we knew that was politicking. You've been politicking while they were through. It's all Labour's fault that the entire international finance collapsed. We understand that you're politicking. That won't stop us negotiating with you if we have to.
There was an interesting little vignette that I saw, actually, just on that subject, which is that you see politicians hurling stuff at each other across the dispatch box all the time. So, I mean, I remember before the general election, Clegg must have called on Brown to resign at least two or three times during Prime Minister's questions, you know, or he'd say, you need to stand down, or you need to go to the country or whatever. He'd certainly been very insulting towards him. And then there was, I can't remember which of the books, I've read two books about the coalition negotiations, but whichever one it was, there was a point where Clegg and Brown were talking, and Clegg made it clear to Brown that he would have to stand down if there was to be any chance of a Labour Lib Dem rainbow type coalition, and that he was really, really hurt by that. And it kind of brought home to me that all that stuff in the Commons really is just theatre, and they don't really mean it a lot of the time. It's kind of they say it because it's what they have to say, and then when they're in private and they're talking to each other, they're obviously a lot more friendly and just human, basically. And the fact that Clegg was saying to Brown, "You're going to have to stand down," and he clearly meant it. It wasn't just for the cameras and for the microphones. And so, I guess I'm sort of agreeing with what you just said there, really. But it just reminded me of that, and this whole kind of politicking thing. I mean, I'll be honest with you, it often drives me nuts, some of this stuff. I mean, maybe I'm too pedantic because I try and not say things that I don't mean. So maybe I wouldn't be very good as a politician because I guess they sort of have to say things that they don't mean a lot of the time. But I do wish.
You certainly do. If you're acting under collective responsibility, it is very hard not to at some point.
I know, but that, I mean, I have written about this over the years. I've written about this over the years, and that drives me nuts. I really do wish that politicians could say, "Do you know what? I actually don't agree with this policy, but collective responsibility means I have to vote for it. Let's move on to another subject." But instead, what happens is your John Humphreys and your Jeremy Paxmans, they niggle away. They know which ministers don't agree with what policy, and they'll ask the same question over and over and over again, forcing them to lie or forcing them to come up with some ridiculously contrived form of words. It's just so tedious and it's pathetic. You know, do we really honestly think that every single member of the current government or any previous government agrees in total with every single policy that government has ever put out? And it's just like, and I really do think that this is one of the things that turn people off politics, because, most of my friends don't give a flying toss about politics. They really don't. And one of the reasons is because they see politicians being interviewed and they don't answer the questions. They don't answer them properly. Or, they say stuff and then it turns out later on that they were lying. They hate all of that stuff. And I do wish that there was a way. I don't really have the answer as to how. I mean, maybe, I don't know, more conscience votes. I don't know. There must be a way to reduce cabinet collective responsibility to a way that allows MPs to be more human. I mean, I just, it's probably never going to happen, is it? Because, this is the way our system has evolved. And, we're seeing, with what we're just talking about, that, I fully accept that this collective responsibility means the Lib Dems aren't going to be able to vote the way that they want to. And I also fully expect that we'll be attacked for that. And this will be another thing that will be in leaflets. The Lib Dems wanted a mansion tax. They had a chance to vote for the mansion tax. They didn't vote for the mansion tax. The reason is they can't, and that's going to be used against the party.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would.
Okay.
Because I'm good at politics.
I'm good at whinging about politics. Okay. And the other thing just about the mansion tax is that I think the Lib Dems have talked today about perhaps widening it or making it cumulative so that people who own more than one property, it would actually be the 2 million threshold. It wouldn't just be on single properties. It would be if you had 3, 4, 5, 6 properties, they would add it all up. And if it came to over 2 million, then you'd be taxed on that. I mean, I personally don't have a problem with that. I think if you're going to have a property tax with a threshold, then why shouldn't it include multiple houses? If anything, it would seem a bit strange that it didn't, really.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think, I completely agree. The only question would be, for me, whether Labour were planning something else on second homes that would be more punitive, and whether that would affect it. But if they weren't, and I don't know if we are or not, then absolutely, bring it on.
Probably not much more to say on that than seeing as we agree. So the next thing that we thought we might talk about is the Eastleigh by-election. So obviously we have already talked about this on previous podcast, and things are hotting up a little bit. There's been a story that came out, I think it was yesterday, about Maria Hutchings, who is the Tory candidate. And she made some comments about one of her children who she said is very gifted and that it's impossible for him to get the right education in the state sector, so that they've sent him private.
Because he wants to be a cardiovascular surgeon.
Yeah, I think it was cardiorespiratory surgeon. And that bit was actually a kind of separate sentence afterwards. And I did, because I blogged about
it. It depends very much on where the punctuation was in the sentence, I think.
That's true. I mean, the way I've seen it written down is that there was a full stop and then she talked about him wanting to be a cardiorespiratory surgeon. I know Ian Dale blogged about this. He said that some of Maria Hutchings' children have autism, apparently, that this is in the public domain, and that he wasn't sure if maybe this child also had that condition. And that maybe they had tried, but that was all speculation. And I, from what I heard, that actually isn't true. But I'm not sure. And actually, to be honest, I don't really want to know all the details of Maria Hutchings' children. I actually don't think that my party should be using her children against her in a by-election campaign. I don't know if that is being put on leaflets at the moment. I saw one that I think Stephen Tall had mocked up, which certainly looked like the kind of thing that the party might do, which was talking about how our candidate, Mike Thornton, his daughter went to a state school and is now at university. Sorry?
Mr. Charisma.
Yes, that's the one. His daughter went to a state school and is now at university studying medicine. I don't think we should be pushing this, and I think there's a couple of reasons. Firstly, I really don't like it when politicians' children are dragged into political campaigns. I know she dragged her own son in by mentioning him, but I still don't think we should be using that against her. I think we should. There's plenty to attack her on. I mean, she's clearly a liability. She's coming out with all kinds of stuff. You know, there's plenty that we can attack her on without having to use her children. The second reason is more pragmatic. It's that Nick Clegg was facing similar questions to this a few weeks ago. And I was very clear. I mean, I was defending him and saying that, you know, people shouldn't be trying to use Nick Clegg's children against him. You know, it's his choice and his wife's choice, and it shouldn't really be any of our business. You know, I try and be consistent as far as I can, and I see no reason why it shouldn't apply with Maria Hutchings. My concern is that if we really go for her on this, as soon as Nick Clegg starts making the decision about where he sends his children to school, it's open season.
Nick Clegg in Hypocrisy Shocker.
Well, I don't know. Is it hypocritical? I don't know how much control Nick Clegg has over what goes on leaflets that are going out in Eastleigh, to be honest.
I think he has to answer for them, ultimately. You'd expect Ted to do the same. I think that there are two different things there. I don't think that talking about a decision an adult makes about their children is bringing their children into it. If we start talking about whether Maria Hutchins' children are autistic or whether her children make bad choices in life or whether they make good choices in life, and start judging the children for going to private school, then that's different from judging an adult for sending their child to private school and saying that the schools that she will be representing in her constituency, if she were to win, are not good enough. Not good enough for her kids, good enough for all those poor kids, but not good enough for her kids. That's the same problem I have with Nick Clegg. There are plenty of good schools. I went to them, you know? It is a misnomer that there are not good state schools. It's absolute nonsense. It's frankly bollocks, and I will not have it. Gifted, I don't know what she means by gifted. I suspect she means I've got quite a clever kid. Well, good. They'll do very well then. That's what happens to clever kids in school. They do very well. I went to a state school. I'm quite clever. I did okay, you know? I'm not stacking shelves, and I suspect we'll get onto stacking shelves later. My brother is, because he had a completely different type of lifestyle, completely different approach to academia. He wasn't interested. He's really happy stacking shelves, and there's nothing wrong with that. And if Maria Hutchins' kids grows up to stack shelves, that's good too. But it's not about which school you went to. It's about the type of journey that you take. And you can do that without buying your kids. All you're doing is buying your kids a network of influential friends, and that's all that you get. That and this training into how to be frankly, I would not put my kids through private school in a million years, because I don't want them to grow up to be the kind of awful people that the majority of people I've met who went to private school are, because they get trained into being arrogant. And I've met some lovely people who've managed to break their conditioning, but it clearly is quite difficult. So I think you can absolutely judge Nick Clegg, judge Maria Hutchins, judge Diane Abbott. And this is not a party political point, because our people absolutely shouldn't be doing it. If you genuinely believe that inequality, as socialists do, is an evil, you should not be perpetuating that for your own children by just making sure they're at the top of the pile rather than the bottom.
Okay. Yep. Well, I mean, Maria Hutchings, she's a Tory. You'd expect Tories to do this.
Yeah.
So
government can't judge her for her decisions.
Yeah, but... We've already seen in this discussion, as I introduced it and you've commented on it, we've already had to speculate about whether her child has autism. We don't know. We don't know the full story. She describes him as very gifted, in quotes, and that, in her exact words, it's impossible for the state sector to cope with that. Now, I would definitely quibble very strongly with the term impossible. I think that I agree with you. That's bollocks. The state sector can definitely cope with gifted children. It definitely can. But I don't know all the details of this. I don't know what state schools they tried or looked at. I don't know. I just don't know. I don't have all the information. So to then say that it's wrong for her to do what she did about her individual child in her individual circumstances, I can't possibly know that, and neither can anyone else. And you find yourself getting sucked into all this speculation about what might the problem be or might not the problem be. It's none of our business.
She's a Tory and she thinks she can pay to get better.
But we don't know. That's the truth. And the more you talk about this, the more you realise that you're just speculating about stuff. And you're speculating about the life of a child who hasn't chosen to be
well,
the centre of
it. You brought the autism in. I don't think that should be part of the discussion at all.
But it already is. I brought it in because already people are writing about it.
Well, that was Ian Dale, and I wouldn't have gone there, frankly. I don't think it's necessary. It's the same with last week. There was no need to talk about Chris Hughne's kids. There's plenty enough ammunition against Chris Hughne. But if Chris Hughne had chosen to educate his kids privately, I would criticise him for that, because that's Chris Hughne's choice, not Peter Hughne's.
Mm. Okay. I mean, I have to say, most people that I've come across in my own party on this subject don't agree with me. They think that actually Maria Hutchings is fair game when it comes to this subject. She brought it up, and it's a perfectly legitimate topic for us to attack her on in a by-election. And, you know...
I mean, you are going to be in massive, massive trouble if you go hard on her on this and then Nick Clegg sends his kids to private school.
Yeah.
And that, again, that's political. That's politics. Nick Clegg has a problem with people thinking he's a liar. This isn't going to help him.
Yeah, I totally agree. And therefore, we shouldn't do it. Well, actually, there's other reasons as well, but that's one of the reasons why we shouldn't do it. But I think we are going to do it. You know, this is a gloves-off by-election campaign. I can see it coming now. It's like a slow-motion train crash in that aspect of it, because you're right. When it comes to Nick Clegg, you know, all bets are off. And, you know, I don't think I'll go on the radio and defend him again if we do this in Eastleigh, because, you know, they'll just throw Eastleigh at me and I'll look stupid. Anyway, and also, your candidate, John O'Farrell, who was chosen this week. And for anyone who doesn't know, there's probably no one listening who doesn't know, but he's a comedy writer, and he worked on Spitting Image, and he's written a number of books, one of which was about his time in when Labour were in opposition between 1979 and 1997, as he was an activist, right from when he was a teenager right through until 97. And one of the things that he wrote in that book was about how when the Brighton bomb went off, he found himself wishing that she was dead, I think is what he said. He's been attacked for this, and I've seen stuff on Twitter today saying he needs to apologise for it and, you know, make his position clear. Does he still think that? I read that book, and this was years ago, before I was ever a member of any political party. I thought it was a wonderful book, actually. I thought it was a very searingly honest memoir of a young political activist growing up, in more ways than one, actually. Through the time of the book, it makes it clear, if I remember correctly, that he does realise that some of his views when he was very young were a bit silly, and, you know, that he obviously gets more mature as time goes on. But he was just very honest about how he felt. I remember the agonies that he went through during the Falklands War, when, you know, he wasn't happy about the fact that the war had happened, but he wanted to support the troops. So he was kind of campaigning against the war, but also trying to campaign for the troops. And there's all kinds of struggles throughout that book like that. And I mean, my point is, he was just honest about it. And now he's being attacked for that when he's 52, and he's being told he has to apologise for it and he has to recant. Even though he was just writing about feelings that he had 30 years ago. I just think that's wrong. And this is, again, another thing that I hate about election campaigns, when people are told they have to apologise for things that they said 30 years ago when they were virtually a child. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it's insane. He's a comedy writer. He writes funny things. He wrote a funny thing that he acknowledged at the time was wrong. I think in the book it says, "I wish she was dead. That was a terrible thing to think." Mm. Something very much along those lines. So it's like, it's not like he hasn't already said, "That was bad. Shouldn't have done that." And I mean, it's basically, the thing is also, is saying in 1984 that "I wish Thatcher was dead, but that was a bad thing to say," is a bit different than saying it in fact, saying it in 1998 about yourself in 1984 is quite different from saying it in 2013 when she's a very frail, very ill old woman. And now there are a lot of people who, and I've written about how stupid this is, people who are, you know, I'll be at the street parties and we'll dance on her grave and what have you. Now, I hate Thatcher. I hate Thatcher, and I hate, more than I hate Thatcher, I hate Thatcherism. Thatcher herself will die. The ideas that she's left behind and the damage that she's done to this country are living on. And it's only when those go that I'll celebrate. And I suspect it's going to be an absolutely awful, awful time to be on the left when Thatcher does die, which she is a human being. It is going to happen, because you will get the right absolutely eulogising and idealising her. And anyone who says anything will be being disrespectful. And so it's better to just take yourself completely away from it. I think I'll go and spend 2 weeks in Spain by a beach and just ignore the lot. Because it's just pointless to try and have that argument at that time in that way. But what the Daily Mail have done is try to take all those emotions that are around this frail old woman and the occasional controversy that spikes up. I think there was one last October about some T-shirts and various other things.
It was a Labour activist who was wearing a T-shirt that said something about wanting Thatcher dead, and Ed Miliband happened to be in the picture smiling. I don't think he'd noticed what was written on the T-shirt or something. Yeah, pathetic.
Have you ever met Ed Miliband? He's so tall, he's not going to see what's written on your T-shirt from that lofty height. He'll really not be looking at your tummy. Basically, the Mail are just trying to cause a bit of trouble for the Labour candidate, which is interesting because it shows that we are actually having an impact in this by-election. So all in all, the Mail are being stupid. That's not news. I'm quite interested to know that they're being stupid, because it means that my £20 bet might have a little bit more legs than some people say it does.
Mm, what odds did you get for that?
14 to 1.
I think you're going to lose.
I reckon it's well worth a £20 punt on 14 to 1. Mm. If it doesn't come in, I've lost 20 quid. If it comes in, well, hey.
Mike Smithson on Political Betting Today is predicting that UKIP will beat Labour into fourth place. So I don't quite know what he's basing that on. But he usually is quite, in the know on these things as to how the betting markets are moving. So I think you might lose that 20 quid, unfortunately.
Well, we shall see. It was worth the odds. The odds were worth it. Mm. We've had a good week and we've got a great candidate. And we've got a candidate who is sucking in activists from all over the country because of who he is, because of that wonderful book. People love him, and people are coming from every single corner of the country to campaign for him in Eastleigh, which is great. And it means that we've got a genuine, you know, dog in the race.
Mm. Have you read any of his other books?
I read his second book, the one about advertising.
Yeah, I think I've read all his fiction stuff. I was quite disappointed when he stopped banging them out a few years ago. I think he's a good guy. And, you know, I'm glad that you've got a good, credible candidate. Like I said, I really do want Labour to, to fight this election, this by-election and give it a good go. And they clearly are doing. So fair play to him. But obviously, I still want our guy to win. But, you know. OK, so the next thing.
Yeah, your candidate is interesting. Well, no, he's not. And that's what's interesting about him. God, I saw him on news night. He needs some media training sharpish.
Does he? I didn't see that, actually.
Oh, God, it was... Well, I mean, it would have been a car crash if they hadn't also interviewed Maria Hutchins, and everyone was kind of, okay, she's a bit, whoa. Mm. So he kind of got away with just being really, 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 really bad at television.
I mean, I guess the Lib Dems must have made the calculation that someone with that level of local credentials, he's been there 20 years, he's been a councillor, etc. Trump's, getting someone in who's particularly media savvy, who probably wouldn't have the local connections. So it'd be interesting to see how it plays out, I guess.
It's also really great that you're going out on a limb as a party and really you're going to change the makeup of your party there. I think it's really exciting that you haven't chosen another middle-aged white man.
Well, I think I've made my thoughts on that clear in the past. And yeah, it'd have been nice if they'd have chosen, either a woman or someone from an ethnic minority or both. But hey, what can you do?
Choose someone?
Well, you know, I was in charge of the selection process.
What can you do?
Okay, if we move on to, we want to talk about maybe a couple more things if we get time. The work for decision. So this is Kate Riley, who is 24, and she was volunteering in her local museum because she wanted to be a geologist. And then she was forced by the Department of Work and Pensions, on pain of having her benefits taken away, to go and work in Poundland. Now, I think we talked about this subject before, haven't we? Because I know we got into an argument about shelf stackers.
Indeed.
But the reason why it's newsworthy is because there was an appeal, and it's been upheld, hasn't it? Her position has been upheld. So it was deemed that the Department of Work and Pensions were wrong.
Most of the DWP's workfare schemes have been held to be illegal under the decision.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I haven't gone into a lot of detail on this, but from what I can tell, maybe you'll correct me if I'm wrong here, it seems to be more kind of technicalities around the edges of this rather than the court saying that this scheme is completely wrong and you have to scrap it full stop. I think that if the DWP go away and dot some I's and cross some T's, they can probably still do this. Is that right?
They need to pass some emergency legislation to do that.
Okay, so a bit more than dotting I's and crossing T's, yeah. But presumably they will do that because they really want this scheme.
Well, yeah, because Ian Duncan Smith is a complete ideologue and is incapable of giving up schemes that don't work. I suspect in a month or so we'll be having a conversation with similar tones about universal credit.
Well, I think I've said before, I think universal credit will collapse under the weight of its own unworkability, frankly. But we'll maybe talk about that on another podcast. I mean, I think the thing I found particularly egregious about this case is she was already doing what the Department of Work and Pensions want people to do. She was already volunteering for free in an area that should have been helpful to her own career. To then take her away from that, to get her to work in Poundland, which was nothing to do with her degree or what she was trying to get into, is crazy, considering that she wasn't getting paid for that either. It just seemed completely ridiculous to me. So even if, and, you know, I don't agree with workfare anyway, but even if I did agree with workfare, I would still have thought that the way that she was treated was stupid, completely wrong-headed. And so it makes me worry that once they do get this emergency legislation and they get it back in again, they need to have, if they're going to have this policy, they need to be smarter about how they implement it. They need to take individual circumstances into account, because they clearly didn't here. If they had have done, they would have said, you know what? She's already volunteering in a museum. She's following the principle of what we're trying to get people
to society.
Do. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. So it kind of makes me think, I mean, I don't like it.
That's a bit of a sham.
Well, I don't like it when people throw around terms like, you know, ideological. You just used that about Ian Duncan Smith. I don't like it. I don't like it unless I think there's very strong evidence for it. But in this case, I'm starting to wonder what any other explanation for it could be. Because if it's not ideological, if it's not just everyone has to do exactly what we say, you know, there's no room for manoeuvre at all. And it just seems absolutely ridiculous. You know, if I'd been in her position, I'd have done exactly what she did, you know. The idea that you take the government to court because you don't like, you know, what Ian Duncan Smith tried to imply is that this girl didn't think that stacking shelves was good enough for her. I don't think that's true at all.
Yeah, actually, today he's been interviewed and he said that she thought she was too good to stack shelves. Now, you know that I think that that is a prevalent thought amongst people that I absolutely loathe for personal reasons, because my brother stacks shelves, but also because I think it's snobbery. But Ian Duncan Smith has got it completely the wrong way around. Nobody is too good to stack shelves. Stacking shelves is a good job that should be valued and therefore paid. And that's the problem with workfare, is that it's unpaid.
But also he said something really stupid, I thought, which was that he said, if you turn up in your local Poundland and none of the shelves are stacked, then, you know, then you'll realise that shelf stackers are more important than geologists. And that's such a facile thing to say. I mean, training to be a geologist, you know, the career paths of geologists and shelf stackers are completely different. The idea that one is better than the other, or, you know, it's just crazy. It's like he was completely floundering and he just is coming out with complete rubbish now, because that has no coherence at all, what he said there. It doesn't make any sense.
No, I mean, to be quite honest, there are some politicians that I disagree with but think, yeah, they're quite clever. It's hard to disagree with him. You have to be quite fleet of mind to follow what they're saying, to follow what the argument against them might be. Ian Duncan Smith is not one of those. He has worked, he has very, very set ideas about what causes poverty, and he won't listen to anybody else about them. So he set up the Centre for Social Justice to take those basic principles that he believes in and work policy around that rather than around any of the other evidence that there might be, or reality, or, you know, people who know what they're talking about, or people who are in poverty. And so he has this very concrete set of ideas, and he's sold them really well to the Tory party. They think he's absolutely got it right. And therefore, he and Michael Gove are the two ministers most often quoted as getting it right, because they've taken some very specific policies that speak not necessarily to reality or to what's needed or to what's wanted, but to a very specific set of Tory ideas about what causes poverty and what causes attainment, and just run with those ideas in a very, very strict linear fashion, with brooking no opposition or reality. And so this is the problem, is that he's run smack bang up against reality, and it's just, he cannot cope with that. Whereas Michael Gove, much as I loathe him, is probably better at dancing around his ambushes by reality and getting a bit of a motion around that and being a bit more fluid. Ian Duncan Smith can't do that. He just doesn't have that capacity. He's on a set of rails, set of tracks, and he goes until he hits a rock. And he doesn't understand what's happened when he hits a rock.
So I was going to say about Ian Duncan Smith, because he was a disaster when he was leader of the Tory party. But I think, I don't know, maybe I'm too sentimental, but I do tend to have a soft spot for former leaders of parties. Michael Howard's an exception to this, by the way. But generally, I think if someone's risen to be leader of a party, then they deserve some respect afterwards, really, you know, in general. And I did think that the way Ian Duncan Smith had come back from what was a pretty brutal defenestration and, you know, spent years going around the country, visiting all these places and, you know, sink estates and so on and so forth, and putting in the groundwork and trying to understand what was going on there and what might work to try and improve things, and setting up the CSJ. And so I'd hope that when the Tories got into government that he would do some good, because he'd spent so long. I mean, most ministers that take over departments haven't spent almost a decade going around the country trying to understand what to do about the department that they end up running, whereas he had. And so I had quite high hopes.
Him and Andrew Lansley, look how well that went out.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Lansley, I was going to say that, it's the same. I mean, let's not talk about the NHS again after last week. We'll save that for another week. But yeah, I had quite high hopes that IDS at least understood what was needed and would have a crack at it. But the more I see, the more I fear that he really hasn't got it. I mean, this workfare thing, I think, is pretty disastrous. But the universal credit, I just think it is going to collapse. I can't see it working. And I think.
But the problem is they've taken out, they're taking out all the systems that build up to it. So there's nothing to go back to. If it collapses, there's nothing there. You can't go back to the system you had before until universal credit will work, because they're being removed.
I really fear that it will become this government's poll tax, and actually it may be 10 times worse than the poll tax for them. I really do fear that. And that's coming, I think I said this on a previous podcast, because I know about computer systems. I've been working in computers for 20 odd years now. I know how they work and how they don't work. I know what they're capable of. I know when you take something that in a small scale pilot seems to work and then try and scale it up 1,000-fold, it can just become an absolute nightmare. And if you've kicked away all the props from underneath you and you can't roll back to the previous systems, well, let's just say I hope I'm proved wrong for the sake of the country. But I really do fear that this is going to be a nightmare.
I think it's going to make Les Miserables look like a musical.
Yeah, maybe we need someone to argue strongly in favour of the universal credit on a future podcast, try and convince me that I'm wrong about this.
I mean, I think there are two arguments about the universal credit, which it would be useful to get the other side to hear from. One is the, I don't have that much of a problem ideologically with everything being rolled into one. There are some issues around it being household-based rather than individual-based, particularly in terms of women. But if you could sort that, if you can iron those out, but it's just that, will it work? If we could get someone on here who's going to convince us it would work, that would be very interesting, because I've never met anyone who, of throughout the political spectrum, who can tell me how the technicalities of this are going to actually work.
It might be quite interesting trying to find, even trying to find someone who could do that, let alone, you know, whether or not it's likely to be true. Okay, well, maybe we'll try and find someone for a future podcast on that. I'm sure there'll come a point in the next few months when that is the main story. So I'm sure we'll revisit this. The last thing we thought we might just touch upon is the Sun's coverage of the death of Reeva Steenkamp, who was Oscar Pistorius's girlfriend. There was a front cover of the Sun the day after, which talked about the death, but then it had a picture of her in a provocative pose in a bikini, which, I don't know, I'm not really sure there's much we can say about this. Isn't this just par for the course? I mean, I thought post Leveson maybe we'd see less of this.
You think while they were still sorting out, while the government was still in negotiation about what they were going to do with Leveson, that the Sun would have had the fucking brains just not to do something that stupid?
But it makes me
provocative. It's like sticking two fingers up at David Cameron and saying, you know how you like were totally on our side on Leveson? Yeah. Just ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to use the middle finger, but same thing. I was talking to someone on Twitter about this, and they said that you've got to be careful to separate out, you know, what Leveson was arguing for and just general tabloid stuff. But I'm not sure there's really that much of a distinction, because so much of what Leveson was about is a kind of logical endgame of the tabloid tactics that we see. Mm-hmm. So all this stuff here where you've got, I mean, a woman who's just died, and the first thing they do is slap a picture of her in a bikini on the front page. And if I read correctly, because I don't buy the Sun, so I didn't see it, but I read that that day they didn't have a page 3. It was almost like all
the... Why would you need one? They've got the wank material on the front page.
Well, I mean, that's the reason why, if I was the editor of the Sun, well, this is a crazy notion anyway, because if I was the editor of the Sun, it would be nothing like it is. But if I was in that position, I'd have left page 3 in, because doesn't that just massively give the game away? Why you've put it on the front cover? I mean, I've seen comments like, oh, well, you know, it's because that was her job.
Well, next time a young biochemist is murdered, I'm sure they'll always use shots of her in a white coat and goggles.
Yeah, exactly.
And not some nice pretty pic from her holiday snaps.
It's a load of rubbish, isn't it? I was reading some article, I think it was by, I can't remember her name, someone writing...
Marina Hyde.
That's it, Marina Hyde. You obviously read the same one, where she was talking about how they used to do the briefing of, you know, if you could get a picture of...
The priest is 30,000 hits.
That was it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it, yeah, I think it came down to Jerry Halliwell was an extra 10,000, which I thought was a bit harsh. But
different strokes for different folks, I guess.
I suppose.
But I guess, thought it was quite high.
Yeah, maybe if Jerry Halliwell was in her, you know, Brits, you know, Union Jack dress, maybe that would be 50,000. Who knows?
Yeah. Maybe.
But I think the point is that they were quantifying, you know, they almost had mathematical calculation statistics on, you know, how good looking the women are and how many more papers you would sell based upon that. So the idea that they're doing it for anything other than just trying to flog more papers using pictures of women as titillation, and that's clearly what's happening. So ordinarily I still have a problem with that anyway, full stop. But when the woman's just been murdered, and actually it's a broader point here as well. I was listening to the radio yesterday, and there was an interview with Oscar Pistorius's family, and they were talking about how devastated they are about this. And I was thinking, where's the interview with Reeva Steenkamp's family?
Yeah, absolutely.
She's the one who died.
She's the invisible female victim of a famous man.
Yeah, and this is a pattern we've seen again and again, isn't it? I mean, I'm reminded of...
Her name was barely on... I mean, if I remember rightly on that front cover, her name was in the small type. His name was in large type.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just disgraceful.
But I suppose it will ever be thus, won't it? Until we see some pretty major structural changes in the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two points to be made about this. Partly we need structural change to the media and the way that... And, you know, Leveson did take evidence on women in the media and the way that women are treated in the media. That was part of the investigation. I don't think it was covered so much in the results, but it certainly came out in the evidence. But I think there's a wider thing, which is that we are... not very good in this country or in this world at talking about and at dealing with the fallout from domestic violence, which is very, very real. And it has actually, yeah, we had The irony of this was that it happened on the day of 1 billion rising, where people all around the world were coming together to protest how terrible we are at domestic violence. And if you wanted a case study right there, you know, that's what we were talking about. You know, it's been released by the police that had been previous occasions of domestic violence call outs between this couple. You know, whether or not, and this will be up to the judge in South Africa to decide, and I believe it is a judge rather than jury system there, whether or not he did shoot her accidentally or it was a murder. You know, we are talking about a woman who was already, who was known for speaking up about domestic violence and yet was in a violent situation herself. And, you know, having known people going through domestic violence, it is, you know, we just do not have a system that in any way recognises how victims are treated, how to cope with what victims go through. And there was another case in this country where a young woman who had been raped by her teacher as a child, and a number of years later the case finally came to court, and he was a very, very well-known man, had an MBE, and she killed herself after testifying because there'd just not been the kind of support necessary for her to go through that hideous experience. And we do not have anything like the kind of culture that A, supports victims, and B, supports women in every aspect of life. I mean, even myself, I'm a very unattractive woman. I know this about myself. And yet every single day I'm subjected to sexual catcalling from somebody on the street. That's just bizarre. And it's only done to belittle me. It's not there to do any... it's not there to make to for someone to try and become my friend. They're just doing it, put me in my place, and I refuse to be put in my place. But I'm lucky because I have that empowerment, and a lot of young girls and women don't. And it's really, really important that we get an understanding of this, because we don't have it at the moment at all. And I think, you know, things like the Everyday Sexism Project are absolutely vital to demonstrate how bad it is in the 21st century for women. And actually moving that on to, well, what the f*** do we do about it then? Because that's got to be the next step. We can't just say, here's how bad it is. We've got to say, here's how we stop it. And it stops with boys. It stops with teaching boys how to behave, not teaching women how to cope with how boys behave. And that is absolutely an essential part of this.
Yeah, and far too often that is the focus, isn't it? And you even see it in, you know, advice about women, you know, what they wear and, you know, what... where they walk and where they don't walk, and, you know, leaving clubs on their own. I mean, you know,
you want to stop women being raped, don't rape women.
Yeah,
very simple.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, it's a bit of a grim note to end on. I mean, you know, if something good can come of this at all, maybe it will be a renewed focus on this subject and maybe some of the measures that you've talked about. But it's pretty depressing stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I think it's really interesting that it has become more prominent. I think in the last year, I think women have started, maybe it's part of the social media explosion, but it does seem that women are speaking up more now. And if we can get a momentum behind that, then maybe things will change. But things have to change at every level, and they have to change with boys.
Well, I have to say, I mean, from my perspective, I mean, I don't consider myself to be sexist, but I guess most blokes would say that. But I have been pulled up a few times in the last few years by people. It has made me think about whether there is a level of unconscious, I wouldn't say sexism, but, you know, just kind of accepting that things are the way they are structurally and hierarchically and, you know, the whole kind of patriarchy thing. And it has made me think. And I do try and, for example, you know, when I'm at, I mean, something you've talked about before, when I'm at events, and there's a panel, I'm always now looking, are there any women on the panel? And that's not something 3 or 4 years ago I'd have really thought about. I do think about it now.
Bad.
Yeah, and I actually haven't got to the point yet where I've challenged anyone about it, but I have decided that the next time I'm at an event and there are no women on the panel, I am going to go up to the chair afterwards and ask, who organised this? And I'm going to try and speak to them and say, why aren't there any women? Couldn't you find any?
Mark, what you need to do is not go up to them afterwards. What you need to do is start, put your hand up, be the first questioner and say, I'd like to ask two questions. Here's my main question. And B, why have I got no woman to ask this question of? Because until we challenge this publicly, humiliate people about this, it won't change.
It's a very good point, you see. This is my classic style, isn't it? That I'm more kind of low-key consensus, whereas you're more kind of in your face and just go for it. But yeah, you're right. I probably should do it like that. Okay.
Excellent. I look forward to hearing the story of it.
All right. Well, that's my pledge. The next time I'm in a situation like that, that's assuming I get called to ask a question. I usually do, because I usually stick my hand up quite sharpish, because I've got quite a lot to say. All right. We better leave it there for now.
Okay.
So I'd just like to thank Emma for your time tonight. Emma, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
I think it's been a good discussion. We should have a guest next week. Still waiting to get things confirmed, so I won't announce who it is. But hopefully that will be the case next week. I'd also like to thank Audio Boo, who very kindly host this podcast for us. And I'd also like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompitech.com, who does our funky theme music. And we'll be back next week.